One of the strangest things about the Wars of the Roses is that no one, and I mean no one, called it that at the time. The name was not to come until much later. At the time, it was just a series of fights, and we just had one in the podcast, the fight between Richard, Duke of York, and Edmund, Duke of Somerset, about who should be running the country on behalf of the rather useless, almost sock puppet of a king, Henry VI. It was a short war, as war goes. It had lasted a few days, if that. There'd been one battle, less than 50 dead. The Duke of York had won. The very name, the War of the Roses, wasn't even popular in this country until Sir Walter Scott published his fantastical novel, Anne of Geraristin, in 1829, which used the term and made everybody else start using the term. In the 16th century, the historian Samuel Daniel used the term civil wars to describe it. And in Europe, there existed some foreign versions that referred to most of these fights as the Wars of English Succession. We begin this chapter in the aftermath of that first war. The Duke of York had won his conflict with Edmund, Duke of Somerset, and for a prize he got 4 months of everyone hating him before he had to resign the position of Lord Protector, as no one would do what he wanted. However, back in that May of 1456, where we begin, the city is calming down after riots and everyone is taking stock. There's a lot to be getting on with. The younger members of the Mercer's Livery Company had just gone on a rampage across the city, attacking a bunch of Italians. But the city wasn't going after the Mercer's Company for this, so some non-Mercers had been hung and the Livery Company was instructed to police their own. And, as we said last chapter, the protectorate of the Duke of York had fallen. The King of England was now a 34-year-old old man. He spent much of his time planning his tomb in Westminster Abbey. We know he's going to have at least one other attack of his catatonia, and he was rapidly becoming the living, breathing sock puppet that would agree with everything the last person who spoke to him told him to do. But he wasn't there fully yet. Luckily for him, his wife was carved from stone. Queen Margaret was being unusual at this point. She was a woman exercising the powers of state, or trying to. England had not really had many powerful queens. Sure, there'd been exceptions, and London had seen them up close. Back in chapter 57, we had met Queen Matilda, aka Edith of Scotland, the wife of Henry I. She had resided in Westminster and had become for the city the first true royal who lived there full time, a patron and matron of the city. In chapter 64, we had seen King Stephen's wife, Maud, ride into London leading a mercenary force. She liberated the place and was cheered as liberator by the residents. And in chapter 75, the city had witnessed the imperious Eleanor of Aquitaine ride into London to hold it in the name of her son Richard, who was currently based over in the continent. And she was accepted by all as a true ruler of the city and nation. Queen Margaret of Anjou was carved from the same material as those formidable queens. She had grown up in Anjou. She had witnessed her mother and grandmother taking control of her father's territories during periods where he was imprisoned, ruling it in the name of a man and wielding his authority, but in reality doing their own thing. Why should she not do the same in England, either in the name of her rather inept husband or in the name of her infant son? It seems reasonable, yes? And perhaps it could have been, but she was driven by something else, because right now, Queen Margaret hated Richard, the Duke of York, deeply. Whatever he did from this moment on, it had to be remembered that all she saw was a man who had raised an army, killed two of the most important men in the country, left friends of hers dying on the streets of St. Albans, and taken her husband basically hostage. From now on, to the Queen, the Duke of York was simply a bastard. Screw him. And is it really any surprise that relations between the two camps were somewhat strained? And it's this in the background as we enter the second part of the story of London during the Wars of Roses. Welcome then to chapter 163 of this podcast, The 99 Problems of Mayor Geoffrey Boleyn. There were tensions in London, and it should be no surprise that there were tensions in London. It was suspected of being a highly Yorkist-aligned city just after the Duke of York had fallen from power. And of course it was seen as a highly Yorkist-aligned city. In the autumn of 1456, they had elected Thomas Canning as Mayor of London. This grocer and half-brother of Thomas and John Young must have at least been heavily suspected of Yorkist sympathies. We've mentioned him in the past, and we will mention in a bit. This guy had come up as part of the pro-York faction. But as the city moved into 1457, London seemed to be hit by a wave of violence which challenged the community's brand new mayor. Did he put the Duke of York first, or would he put London first? And it all started with an incident out in Tilbury. In early February 1457, two Italian ships carrying wool were seized at Tilbury docks. The exact sequence of events are somewhat convoluted, but what we do know is that the troops that seized the ships were deployed at the behest and under the pay of the merchants of the wool staple. They were part of the Calais garrison. So what we have here are the staplers of London and the garrison at Calais, who they paid, seizing ships which were destined for sale in Zealand. This was clear evidence of collaboration from the Yorkist supporting nobles, the Calais staplers, and the mercers and grocers in London, and was bound to lead to, well, according to the king, more disorder in London. He was clearly saying so when he wrote to the mayor on the 22nd of May 1457, a letter that kind of just went, dude, what the hell? And he was correct. The exact details and legality of the ship seizure are confusing, but it fundamentally raised the tensions towards the Italians in the city and towards the ongoing export of wool and cloth to Antwerp and not Calais, which then raised the fury of the not really pacified younger members of the Mercer's Company again. And then they festered for a while, until the 15th century version of a dodgy Facebook post set them all off. See, there was an Italian from Genoa living in London at the time called Galleon Scott. His nickname apparently was Galleon Centurion, but I've not been able to work out why. The rumour was that Galleon Scott was having an affair with the wife of one of the citizens of London. Honestly, the claim is about as truthful as a TikTok video, but like a dodgy TikTok video, some local lads decided it was enough to get them mad about. I mean, in truth, Galleon Scott was probably only guilty of legally shipping wool in and out of the country and avoiding the wool staple with a license from the government. And no doubt then he'd be dealing in cheaper cloths, and that alone would have made him an enemy of the Mercers. But sod it, let's say he's banging someone's wife. Several of the young Mercers who'd survived last year's anti-Italian mobs and been ringleaders of that group began to organise again. In particular, Thomas Thurston and Thomas Ground. These two had form and sought to build upon it. They began organising meetings of Mercers' apprentices and servants out in the fields around Hoxton, away from their masters, and they began to form a new strong confederacy. They were soon having their members taking oaths to live and die as one. Out here in the fields of Hoxton, away from the prying eyes of their masters, they plotted the murder of Galleon Scott, seeking to fall upon him and simply beat him to death. However, this time, the mayor and the authorities do seem to have gotten wind of this conspiracy. As I said a couple of chapters ago, after the Jack Cade incident, London had decided to elect mayors who would not stand for crap from the streets. And it was the case in 1457 that Mayor Canning was somebody who was going to hold to that. The mayor ordered an increase in street patrols. Armed men in the red and white livery of the city would prowl the lanes, enforcing peace and stability. In fact, them doing so gives us one of the little ghosts of London that we see to this day. Everyone knows that the main police force in London is the Metropolitan Force, based out of New Scotland Yard. But within the City of London itself, there exists a separate police force, the City of London Police. And you can spot their officers by the red and white bands they have around their hats. And these bands are traces of this ghost, the armed patrols of Londoners in red and white striped livery, the enforcers of the peace of London, working direct for the mayor and his sheriff, and the ones keeping an eye on the young mercers here in 1457. But the mayor at the time was not relying on big lads armed with maces alone. He was employing spies and his own informants to keep an eye on these young mercers out in Hoxton. And doing so worked. It all paid itself off when on June the 27th that year, Thomas Gurrant was caught trying to start a riot. It transpired that his fellow conspirators had been hiding weapons to use in and around Cheapside. And to be precise, they were storing their weapons to use in an upcoming riot in the cell of Cheapside. Now, you may remember the cell. I mentioned it before. It was a raised platform whose principal use was to be used by the royal family to look at processions going down Cheapside. It had been commissioned by Edward III after his wife and queen almost died when the grandstand they were sitting upon to watch a joust collapsed under them, as we covered back in chapter 118. Now, the Seld, when it was not being used as a royal viewing platform, was used by the Mercer's Company to store things. And it was here Tommy Gurrant and his confederates had collected a bunch of staves, clubs and other weapons to be used during the riot that would cover their attack upon this Italian galleon Scott. The London authorities, however, were waiting, and on the 27th of June, Thomas removed the weapons, stepped out, threw them down into the street and shouted in a clear voice, quote, "Go we hence, for there is an Englishman slain by the Lombards in Lombard Street," unquote. There wasn't any Englishman slain by a Lombard in Lombard Street. Tommy was just saying this to rally some local supporters to start his riot. But, as we said, unfortunately for him, not only were the authorities aware of what was going on, one of the masters of the Mercer's Company was already in place, a man called Hugh Wishy. And to what was probably the 15th century version of a "what the bleeding hell do you think you're doing, Tommy? I know your dad," he was apprehended there and then. The rest of June and July were taken up by a major inquiry launched by the mayor and another roundup of Mercer's servants. As many as 28 may have been imprisoned in Windsor Castle. And it should be noted that someone clearly had a word with Tommy Gurrant that he was facing a serious amount of trouble if he didn't make himself scarce, because in the aftermath of all of this, he was reported to have, quote, "departed and gone," unquote. But the febrile atmosphere in the City of London was not done. The locals in Bridgeward and the nearby Bernard's Inn of Court engaged in ongoing vicious street battles. We're not exactly sure why, but it was probably related to the Crown and Yorkist nonsense. The mayor summoned the principal of Bernard's Inn before him and told him that if there were any future incidents, any and all law students found to be involved would be expelled. And if that wasn't enough, the prisoners in Newgate Jail rioted and took over their own prison, in rebellion, supposedly, against the conditions they had been kept in. All of this was enough to get Mayor Canning to snap somewhat. He had armed men storm Newgate Jail and soon pacified the rebellious prisoners by placing them in irons and fetters. This mayor was going to make sure London kept the peace, or else. Thomas Canning was a man who embodied the spirit of London after Jack Cade. He will keep the peace no matter what. Try and keep London out of the mess. And if it is going to be involved, he would try to do his duty and keep the streets calm. But of course, he was tainted with being a pro-Yorkist. His half-brother had gone to jail for insulting the King in Parliament. What London needed was a new mayor, who would be as tough and as uncompromising as Mayor Canning, but who would not be seen as politically biased as the grocer was. A candidate was found within the Mercer's company who fit the bill. And his name was Geoffrey Boleyn. Geoffrey was a non-native who had moved to the city, gained citizenship, and done very well out of London. He'd risen in social standing originally with the Hatters Company before going on to join the more senior Mercer's Livery Company. He had, by this stage, already been a Sheriff of London, the Alderman of Castle Baynard's Ward, and an MP for London back in 1449, and had been made one of the Masters of the Mercers back in 1454. You've been mentioning his name occasionally over the last few chapters. Mayor Boleyn was not obviously partisan to any faction causing disruption in the country. He just wanted London to be peaceful. His predecessor had shown that with the fighting in Bridge Ward and the way he crushed the armed mobs from Hoxton and the prisoners in Newgate, that if all else failed, the mayor could use a big stick to enforce that peace. Geoffrey Boleyn in 1457 would not be having to act alone as well. Around him he was supplemented and supported by the previous mayors and the mayor to come and the aldermen and the sheriffs. And in truth, at this moment, he represents London's authorities' demand to keep order in the face of a nation that seems to be falling apart at the seams. London may not have been able to control a damn thing about the state of England. They may not have been able to do anything about the growing polarisation of their own citizens. But they can sure as hell make sure that London would function, that order is maintained, and that stability is defended. And this was the obligation upon Mayor Geoffrey Boleyn. An obligation for a London mayor to hold to in the face of all the nonsense around him. And it was to give him a heck of a lot of problems. But we'll come to that. And if his name sounds familiar, well, it should. This is the man whose great-granddaughter was to become Queen Anne Boleyn. And his great-great-granddaughter was to become Queen Elizabeth I. Right now, up to his neck, making sure London stayed calm. He's not the only ghost of future times making a bit of an impact in England right now. Out in Wales, the King's legitimised half-brother Edmund Tudor had gained an incredible elevation in status amidst the nation's nobility because of his marriage in autumn of 1455 to Margaret Beaufort. She was the niece of the late Duke of Somerset and the daughter of his brother, the disgraced soldier John Beaufort, who you may remember I mentioned a few chapters ago and who died possibly by suicide. Margaret was the richest heiress in England, and anyone marrying her would gain immense wealth and power. And so by marrying Margaret, Edmund Tudor gained enormous prestige and standing and cash. I honestly, though, however, can't say a single nice thing about Edmund Tudor, mainly because Margaret Beaufort was 12 years old when he married her. And I hate to say this, but guess what? He consummated that marriage. Yeah. And by the summer of 1456, Margaret was pregnant. There is some justice. Edmund Tudor would never see his child. He died of plague on the 1st of November in 1456. But just under 3 months later, on the 28th of January, 1457, in Pembroke Castle, the 13-year-old Margaret Tudor gave birth to a young son, a baby called Henry Tudor, in what was, by all accounts, a horrendous and traumatic birth, which probably traumatised the young girl both physically and mentally. She would never bear another child. But yeah, I mention it because we know that Edmund Tudor's grandson is going to go on to marry Mayor Geoffrey Boleyn's great-granddaughter. But this is an aside I'm just throwing in purely from foresight. At the time, no one would have seen anything especially significant about either of these men. And as I said, we'll come back to Mayor Boleyn later. England was at the time getting on with the recovery from this first war. Mercifully, it had been short, and mercifully, it was over. And there was technically no reason for a follow-up conflict. Was there? Understand, I wish to talk about London, mostly, so while I could indulge in repeating the work of much greater historians, who could pore over the minute-by-minute account of the king and his actions and infer meaning behind 100 different source documents about what was going on right now, I realised it's beyond me to do this subject justice, so I'm just going to summarise while focusing mostly on London. We know that Henry VI, despite me calling him a sock puppet, did try to show his authority immediately after the resignation of the Duke of York. On 25th of February 1456, Henry VI was in Parliament to agree and give assent to the terms of his Lord's Protector's dismissal, but a compromise was reached. It seemed to be Henry's desire to try and reconcile a bit with the Duke of York. Sure, he lost his title as Lord Protector, but he didn't use his employment. He remained part of the regime. He was an important councillor, a lieutenant, just not protector. And it's now time for a more accurate update to the War of the Roses scorecard. War of the Roses scorecard, February 1556, updated edition. Number of wars, 1. Number of times Henry VI has been captured, 1. Current regime, Henry VI trying to show he is now king and he can rule without help. Until the middle of August that year, there was no sudden change in direction for the affairs of state. York's loss of the protectorate did not mean dismissal for himself or his principal associates, the Earls of Salisbury and Warwick. They continued as royal councillors. Henry did not dismiss the Earl of Warwick as captain of Calais. Warwick did face some issues. The huge garrison in Calais, having been treated so badly and unpaid by a succession of previous leaders, were reluctant to admit him as their boss. The staplers of London were happily offering to pay him to pay them, but it was only after the staplers came up with the required arrangements to cover lost wages in the April of 1456 that the Earl of Warwick showed up there. And in fact, the Earl of Warwick only really gained this post because of a small amount of political help from Henry VI. But again, Henry wasn't acting all resentful towards the Duke of York. That May, the Duke of York was being sent by the King north to fight the Scots. And it's clear that by the summer of that year, 1456, even though Henry VI is reasserting only his nominal rule, he seems to have accepted the wisdom of keeping York in a prominent role in the government. For a king no longer able to govern or lead his armies in the field, this was actually a very sensible decision. York could be useful. But then, something happened. Maybe it was a second attack of his illness, we don't actually know. But we do know that the Queen persuaded her husband to leave London and move to Kenilworth Castle, where the defences were strengthened with cannon, a considerable battery of 26 new field guns. Everything changed. From the moment he relocated to the Midlands, Coventry, not Westminster, became the centre of the royal court. And we know from documentation that there was a severely diminished level of government business, even less than during his first bout of madness. The government of England was largely abandoned. From mid-August 1456 until about July 1460, the king would now spend one-third of his time either in holy abbeys or priories. There followed 3 years and 8 months without a single parliament. Now, this could be because the Parliament of 1453 had granted Henry VI a bunch of taxes and subsidies for life, which means he didn't have to summon Parliament to ask them for cash. But as well as customs duties, we know that the royal household was gaining roughly £1,000 each quarter from the mayor and the Society of the Calais Staples, which the Crown was using to cover household expenses, and that's in return for their license. So the king not needing cash meant that the royal court didn't need to summon a parliament. The problem was, however, they also began to not pay their debts. Bottom line was that the move by King Henry to Kenilworth in August 1456 and of the royal court to Coventry basically signified a complete collapse of normal political life in the country. The signs are that by that autumn, Henry was still not entirely hostile to York, but the Queen was known to be. York was still able to attend the Great Council meeting, summoned to Coventry on the 7th of October, and there he was reported to be in good standing with the King, but not the Queen. Slowly, but surely, tensions grew. And it was these tensions going on around London that now impacted upon Mayor Boleyn. Fundamentally, the war was over, the nation's trying to move on, but it can't. The Duke of York had committed violence, seemingly won and then lost, but he was not punished. No one had even been punished. Would anybody ever be? What the hell happened at St. Albans? You see, what was driving this was that at the Battle of St. Albans, the two big names who died there, Edmund Beaufort, the Duke of Somerset, and Henry Percy, the Earl of Northumberland, had left a bunch of sons and heirs who were determined to avenge their families. Henry Beaufort, the brand new third Earl of Somerset, was not only 20 years old, he was also lucky to be alive. He'd come out of the Battle of St. Albans horrendously injured, having stood by his father during his father's last stand. And Henry Percy the Younger, the third Earl of Northumberland, was 36, and along with his other brother, Thomas Lord Egremont, had a lot of unresolved anger issues towards the Neville family. The Percys and the Nevilles had already been engaged in a blood feud before the Battle of St. Albans. Now things were worse. These young men and their friends were, well, everybody knew they were resentful as hell against the Yorkists. A situation that only promised increased instability in the future. And King Henry, or those around him, decided that rather than allow a blood feud and personal vendetta spill into more murderous violence in the future, the two sides should be brought, quite literally, hand in hand to make peace and foster friendship under the royal blessing. In 1457, the king tried to solve the issue. A great council meeting was summoned for some date around about the 12th of October. But by the 20th of November, it was abjured because very few people turned up. The purpose of it was to, quote, set apart such variants as to be betwixt diverse lords, unquote. The king was openly trying to organise meetings that would gather everyone together to make the peace. Possibly because of the incredible poor show-up, he then adjourned the meeting until January 1458. Then he appeared in Westminster, personally to address the evils of dissension in the land. York, Salisbury and Somerset were present, but there were still many people who were not there. From February until March of 1458, King Henry moved to Buckhamsted Castle, and this council he had wanted that brought everybody together was resummoned again. This time it was to be summoned to London, and this time people decided Yeah, they'd go.
And quite literally, all the lords of England, at odds with each other and who hated each other, were now all making a beeline towards London. And Mayor Geoffrey Boleyn sat there, looked out, saw this, and no doubt went, "Oh, shit." Because immediately, Geoffrey Boleyn had 99 problems, and all of them were armed. See, the council to make the peace, it got everybody's support, and the Lords of England began arriving in London, but when they turned up, they were turning up with an armed retinue. And they were turning up with an armed retinue because things were so unstable that no noble was going anywhere without quite a few lads who were packing heat, which meant that London now found itself facing several potentially thousand men showing up, all armed, all ready to kick off against those armed guys over there who their bosses hated. Geoffrey Boleyn found himself facing a shitstorm, and now what follows is an extended operation in crisis management. It's one thing to do what his predecessor did and deal with rebellious mercers and Bolshie law students and violent prisoners, but these are soldiers with weapons. It started easy enough. One source at the time wrote, quote, "The king came to Westminster last week. The Duke of York came to London with his own household, but only to the number of 140 horse, and the Earl of Salisbury with 400 horse in his company, fourscore knights and squires," unquote. Yep, here is the head of the Neville family and the Duke of York. Crucially, both of them had property within the walls of London. The Duke of York lived over in Castle Baynard. Keeping the peace with them was done as easily as a knock on the door and a polite request to keep their men off the streets. However, as another source then says, quote, "The Duke of Somerset came to London on the last day of January with 200 horse and lodges outside the Temple Bar. And the Duke of Exeter shall be here this week with a great and strong fellowship, as it is said. The Earl of Warwick has not yet come because the wind is not yet favourable for him," unquote. So yeah, the new Duke of Somerset now arrives with a much larger force than the Duke of York. They're based down in Fleet Street outside the walls, but tensions increase, and then 2 weeks later, the Earl of Northumberland, Henry Percy, and his brothers, Thomas Lord Edremont and Sir Ralph Percy, all showed up, and joining them was Lord Clifford. They also stayed outside of the city towards Westminster, but between them, they brought a force of about 1,500 men. Now, the purpose of the meeting was to try and hold talks to reconcile these two sides. And we've got records written on the 15th of March, 1458, of how the negotiations were taking place. Quote, "In the morning is at the Blackfriars for the convenience of the lords who are within the town, and in the afternoon at the Whitefriars in Fleet Street for the lords outside the town. All matters shall come to a good conclusion for God's grace, for the king shall come here this week, and the queen also, and some men say, and my Lord Buckingham with her, and many people," unquote. So, in the morning, the king's negotiators would meet the Duke of York and his supporters in Blackfriars, in the southeast corner of the city. In the afternoon, they'd go to the Carmelite faction, the Whitefriars, next to Temple and Fleet Street, to meet the hostile Somerset faction, and they were trying to negotiate the peace, and around these factions are thousands of armed men, and the presence of so many armed retainers in or near London posed a hell of a challenge for Mayor Boleyn. But the records of the time show, however, that not only was he up for it, it showed the levels he was willing to go to maintain the peace. 535 men were enrolled to patrol the wards of London. A river curfew was imposed from 6 p.m. to 6 a.m. The gates of the city were to be closed during the same hours, and a rota of night watchers were drawn up by the aldermen and for the aldermen of London to supervise. As we said, keeping one side pacified was easy. The Duke of York and the Earls of Warwick and Salisbury lodged within the city. The Duke of Somerset, the Earl of Northumberland, and the Lords Edgemont and Clifford were outside of the city. As well as York owning Baynard's Castle, the Earl of Warwick had a property in Old Dean Street, just west of St. Paul's, and the Earl of Salisbury had a property down in Dowgate Ward. And despite
the desire from the men on both sides, both within London and also outside of the walls, to punch the living crap out of each other, despite the bad blood that had remained in the air since the Battle of St. Albans. The Londoners succeeded. They kept the peace that February and March, even when the Earl of Warwick arrived from Calais late. He brought with him the largest of all the eight groups, 600 men from the bloody hard Calais garrison, now dressed in red livery bearing the white staff of the Earl upon it. And yet, still, London kept the peace. I mean, from early January, the largest lodging houses were packed with lords and their retainers. And it was only in early March when the King and Queen came up to Westminster to open the council proceedings. And during this time, London was increasingly looking like a war zone. But Mayor Boleyn just kept plodding. He kept his overnight night watches. He kept the patrols in the street. And he was helped. Thousands of royal archers were seen posted both inside and outside of the city, guarding the whole Thames corridor from Southwark down to Hounslow, and the talks continued. Even when news arrived that a French raiding force, maybe about 3,000 strong, had landed nearby in Kent, near Sandwich, and then marched on the town, pillaged it, took away loads of merchandise, slayed several people and prisoners, and then pissed off, London stayed calm. Mayor Boleyn had done his job. Eventually, on March the 24th, the King managed to cobble together an agreement between all the sides. Basically, the compromise, let's bury the hatchet agreement to put to bed all the events in the fight in St. Albans. The blame for everything was placed entirely at the feet of the Duke of York and the Earls of Salisbury and the Earl of Warwick and their supporters. I mean, they caused this. The King was able to look with this like the embodiment of law and order. The King's justice on show. You see that battle? This is your fault. But then the King could also show his magnanimity and the power of the King's justice, because he also formally made the punishment for the offending laws to be a series of fines. And with that, all was done. It was over. The agreement was to be the end of it. The Duke of York would pay 5,000 marks of silver to the new Duke of Somerset for the death of his father. The Earl of Warwick would pay £1,000 to Lord Clifford and so forth. And the Percys and the Nevilles were bound over to keep the peace. Please note, York and Warwick's payments to the families of their enemies was not made in cash. Rather, they were to renounce debts owed to them by the Crown, which amounted to similar sums. But still, it was done, said the King. And the next day he decided to demonstrate how the peace would manifest itself. London, and its rather stressed by now mayor, got to see on March 25th, Lady Day in the church calendar, the great tribute to the Virgin Mary, be transformed into the Love Day, a grand procession. All the lords of the land present, along with all their men, were to march symbolically through the teeming streets of London to St. Paul's in a grand display of reconciliation and of burying the hatchet. They processed along the, at this point, fairly militarised streets of London and must have been astonishing, with the major lords being forced to walk hand in hand or arm in arm with the person they hated the most. I mean, there at the front of the parade, apparently, was young Duke of Somerset, linked at the elbow with the old Earl of Salisbury. Behind them came Exeter, walking seemingly harmoniously with the Earl of Warwick. And at the back marched the oddest couple of them all. There's the Queen, accompanied by the man she thinks is a total bastard, Richard Duke of York. And between them all, holding no one's arm, sat on a horse, wearing his crown, is Henry VI, the master of the Love Day and the supposed reconciler of the disparate factions. The party walked with all pomp towards the great cathedral of St. Paul's. That vast church was rammed with a huge crowd to witness this and give thanks for the peace upon the land which the king had granted them. Afterwards, the celebrations began. There was a series of jousts and tournaments in the Tower of London and also at the Queen's Castle down the river at Greenwich. See, everything is solved, let's party! The problem was, nothing was solved. The resentment and anger caused by the Battle of St. Albans remained, and all this rituals did was piss off everyone who was involved. And the feelings festered. The government in 1458 continued to bump along. It was broke, it was dysfunctional. Queen Margaret took the king and the prince back to Coventry following the Love Day, and most of the lords who had filled London with armed men returned to their estates. But the city remained racked with tension. We know that going into 1459, a riot's going to break out on Fleet Street between the locals and those who live down the road in Westminster, and I'll cover that more next chapter. But it wasn't just in London that the post-Love Day atmosphere saw an increase in violence. Trouble continued in the southwest, over in Wales, over in northern East Anglia. The country was seething, and the Queen and the supporters of the Duke of York continued to vie for power. In the autumn of 58, Queen Margaret began to dismiss York supporters and also Neville's supporters from their official positions. But one official position she could not remove, however, was that of Richard, Earl of Warwick, as captain of Calais. Throughout the turmoil of the late 1450s, Warwick held on to this post, which gave him command of the town's garrison, that powerful standing force of soldiers, which was the largest garrison in the country. He had significant military resources, and because the staplers gave him the money to pay the bills, the garrison quickly became loyal to their new commander. See, the Calais garrison had been perpetually broke, and payments to its men forever in arrears. To address this issue, and also to help cultivate his own image, Warwick began to use Calais as a base for what we could best describe as creative resourcing, which is another way to describe piracy. He encouraged pirates. Merchant ships from the Low Countries and Italy were attacked by rogue vessels that just happened to be sailing out of Calais, as was a fleet carrying a load of salt from the Hanseatic League. Goods were plundered on the seas and sailors were bloodily slain. The Earl of Warwick was becoming a pirate king. A similar fate befell a fleet of 28 Castilian ships, which was ambushed by ships connected with Warwick in the summer of 1458. According to a chronicle's rather understated phrase, the seamen involved, quote, bickered, unquote. Actually, a massive naval battle was fought, in which the sea flowed red, as more than 200 Spaniards and 80 men of Calais lost their lives. 300 more were injured. It was a huge battle, and the plunder was then taken back to Calais and sold on to pay back wages to the Calais garrison. And the Calais garrison looked at this Earl of Warwick and they liked the cut of his jib, and they became very loyal to him. The Earl of Warwick was summoned to Westminster in early 1459 to attend a royal council to discuss this matter and other important things, like a rumoured French attack on the south coast. Apparently he came very reluctantly, aware of a strong feeling that he should be removed from his post. And we read then that, quote, the king and queen being at Westminster, there occurred a great quarrel between Richard, Earl of Warwick, and men of the king's household, so much so they would have slain the earl had he not escaped to his barge and went soon after to Calais, of which he'd been made captain shortly before by authority of the Parliament. Soon afterwards, the young Duke of Somerset, by canvassing those who hated the Earl of Warwick, became captain of Calais, and a privy seal was directed to the earl to discharge him of the captainship. However, the earl, for so much had been made captain by the authority of Parliament, would not obey the Privy Seal, but continued exercising the office for many years after, unquote. Whether or not this was a manufactured quarrel designed to do away with Warwick, it certainly came across as that. Warwick had fled London on his barge. He returned to Calais. There'd been an attempt to dismiss him, which he was ignoring. And while the Duke of Somerset claimed the title of Captain of Calais, Warwick held on to it. And this was reflective of what was going on in the country. From the late spring of 1459, both sides began to prepare once more
for an armed conflict. Margaret began doing so through her son's authority. In May, the court again decamped to London, and letters were sent around to the nearby counties demanding a military levy to come to the royal court side. And those who did not comply were threatened with arrest. All around the Midlands and the Northwest, men were privately recruited to the royal retinue and given little badges of allegiance in the form of Prince Edward's livery, a swan with a crown around his neck. A great council was scheduled for June. Suspecting the worst, the Nevilles and the Duke of York refused to attend, as did a number of their sympathisers, including the Archbishop of Canterbury. For their non-attendance, the Yorkists were openly denounced by the Queen. Tensions were rising across the nation. A new war threatened. And in London, Geoffrey Boleyn was not a great mayor. He did not stand out like some of the other names in our city's past. He's not like a John de Guises III or a Roger FitzRoger or even a Serlo de Mercer. But he did his job. And in doing his job, he maintained London's reputation as somewhere that could still hold its own. Well, these are no longer those ancient times. The roar of the London sin can still be faintly heard at the edges of the city. It was a roar of independence soon lost. Like it or not, London was going to have to pick a side in this fight that was brewing. And the choosing of that side, that was going to be dictated by events in London. And I'll cover that next episode. Thanks for listening. Story of London continues each and every week as we plough through the events of the city. And yeah, I hope you're all good. I hope the weather has been kind to you and I hope life has been gentle to you. This is Saul saying thanks for listening. And I'll see you next week for another chapter in the story of London.